Mooney made a note of it, but didn't pursue that line of questioning any further. Eventually, Mrs. Bessemer became more lucid as well. When Mooney asked her whether she remembered being attacked on the gallery, she paused a moment and then said she thought she did. She remembered finding someone in the grocery early that morning. It was a mulatto man, she said, and he asked her for a package of tobacco. When she told the man that the grocery didn't carry tobacco, he chased her. He pursued her back through the grocery, across the hall of the living quarters, to the screened-in gallery, where he struck her with an axe. That, she said, was all she remembered. Here, finally, was something tangible to work with. Mooney alerted his detectives on the crime scene, and by afternoon, they had a suspect in custody. He was Louis Aubuchon, a 41-year-old, light-skinned black man, who had apparently done a few odd jobs for Bessemer earlier that week. Found at his mother's home near the grocery, he'd been questioned about his whereabouts that morning. Aubuchon claimed that he'd been at the Poydras Market since 1 a.m. the night before. But when several witnesses denied this, Aubuchon admitted that he had lied and was evasive about why. He was arrested and taken to the 5th Precinct Station for further questioning. But there were reasons for Mooney to doubt Mrs. Bessemer's story. Why, for instance, would Mrs. Bessemer be tending the open grocery in her nightclothes? Why wouldn't she have screamed while being pursued through the building by an axe-wielding assailant? And why would no one in the populous neighborhood have seen or heard anything at an hour when businesses up and down the street were opening for the day? All in all, Mooney was not satisfied with her account of the crime. And when he questioned Mrs. Bessemer again a short time later, she turned vague and confused. No black man had attacked her, she insisted. If I said so formerly, I didn't know what I was saying. For Mooney, of course, this was maddening. He could see the Bessemer case unraveling in the same way the Maggio investigation had come apart several weeks earlier. In that case, the evidence against Andrew Maggio, the victim's brother, had virtually evaporated under closer examination in the days after his arrest. The murder weapon that had been identified by a witness as Andrew's razor was not, after all, the one the barber had brought home from his shop to hone a nick from the blade. That razor had subsequently been found in Andrew's apartment, and the witness had been forced to admit his mistake. The alleged blood stains on Andrew's shirt, moreover, had proved to be red wine stains. Faced with these embarrassing blunders, Mooney had been obliged to release Andrew Maggio immediately. "The case has taken a peculiar turn," the superintendent had announced to the press, hoping to put a better face on the fiasco. "It has become more interesting from the standpoint of investigators. Tomorrow, we will take up another phase." More interesting or not, the second phase of the Maggio investigation had yielded precisely nothing, and the case remained unsolved. And now Mooney might have to release another man arrested on the mistaken testimony of a witness, with no alternative suspect. Hoping to put the case under tighter control, Mooney decided to deny reporters access to the confused and loose-tongued victims. But this did little to quiet the rampant speculation in the press. "Mystery grows in Orland's axe case," the States reported after a few days of fruitless investigation. The Item's headline was more probing. "Motive of axe mystery puzzles police. What was behind outrage? Who did it?" By the weekend, the case had taken another bizarre turn.
"My husband is a German,"
Mrs. Bessemer blurted during one of her rambling monologues.
"He claims he is not. I don't know where he got the money to buy his store."
In July of 1918, with the United States actively at war with the Germans in Europe, this was an electrifying revelation, full of insidious possibilities. And when police turned up several suitcases in the Bessemer home stuffed with hundreds of letters and pamphlets in Russian, Yiddish, and German, speculation rose to new heights. "Spy plot may be at bottom of axe mystery," the Item announced. Stories were soon circulating about hidden code books, suspiciously expensive clothing, and a footlocker fitted with a homemade secret compartment. If Bessemer was indeed a German spy, the Item wondered, could this explain the violence that had occurred on Thursday morning? Did the woman discover Bessemer's supposed German connections and attack him? Did he have cause to distrust her loyalty and attack her? Did the two have a fearful, silent struggle on the gallery?
Clearly, Mooney, the neophyte police superintendent, was out of his depth. When agents from the Department of Justice arrived to question the Basemers, he was more than willing to turn at least this part of the investigation over to the feds. They began to have Basemer's letters translated and sent agents to Fort Lauderdale to pursue inquiries into the man's alleged business interests there. All of this convinced detectives that the attacks were the result of something other than a crazed axe murderer, but Mooney just wasn't sure. Much as he would have liked to see the Basemer and Maggio cases as unrelated, he was convinced that the same assailant, crazed or not, was responsible for both crimes, and he wasn't afraid to say as much to the newspapers. The fact that Basemer was not Italian did not faze him. Basemer himself admitted that his business practices had upset his Italian competitors, and a neighbor had once even warned the grocer that his rivals might burn him down for his insistence on underselling them. And something else that Mrs. Basemer said was suggestive. On Monday morning, when she seemed to be getting some of her memory back, detectives had questioned her again about the events preceding the attacks.
"The last I remember," she said, "was the evening before, about 6 o'clock, when I saw my husband counting his money at the safe in the grocery store. The door was open, and I said to him, 'Oh, you oughtn't to do that. Anyone can see you, and you will get us both killed one of these days.' But he didn't say anything, and I went back through the hall into the little screened gallery at the end. I don't remember anything more. I don't remember leaving the veranda. I don't remember doing anything there. I don't remember undressing, and they say I was found in my nightgown in bed. Oh, my poor head."
On Tuesday morning, 5 days after the attack, Louis Basemer was deemed healthy enough to be released from Charity Hospital. He was transported directly to police headquarters, where he spent 3 hours talking to Superintendent Mooney and several agents from the Department of Justice. Faced with an attentive audience, the ever-pompous Basemer again waxed grandiloquent, claiming that he was a student of criminology and a born investigator. He would not rest, he said, until he had helped clear up the mystery, and was willing to borrow against his considerable assets. He could easily raise several $100,000, he claimed, in order to get to the bottom of it. Asked further questions about his history, he insisted on correcting a few misunderstandings. First of all, he said, the woman identified as Mrs. Harriet Lowe Basemer was not his wife. She was instead his traveling companion, toward whom he felt as toward a sister, which was why they slept in separate bedrooms. His actual wife was an invalid residing in Cincinnati. He also insisted that he was a Pole, not a German, and that he knew not 9 foreign languages, as had been reported in the press, but 13. And although he still had no recollection of the attack, he was going to consult with physicians at Charity Hospital to recapture the memory psychopathically. Mooney and the federal agents were now uncertain how to proceed. There was clearly not enough evidence to hold Basemer in custody. Possessing letters written in German was no crime, even in wartime, unless, of course, the ongoing translations of them proved otherwise. And while it might be suspicious for a well-traveled, well-educated business tycoon to be running a corner grocery in New Orleans, it wasn't illegal. In the end, they agreed to release Basemer on his own recognizance. But Superintendent Mooney did assign 2 of his men, Detectives Balser and Baradeau, to stay with Basemer, ostensibly to assist him in his investigations, but also to keep an eye on the man, whom no one was prepared to trust fully. That afternoon, Mooney returned to Charity Hospital to speak to the woman calling herself Mrs. Basemer. When asked if she really was married to the grocer, she grew agitated.
"If I am not, he is the greatest deceiver yet," she said. "He was married to me by a Jewish rabbi in New York 2 years ago, and promised to turn Catholic and marry me with a priest, but he never did it."
"Did you have a license?"
"He said so."
"Did you see it?"
"No."
When asked why they slept in separate bedrooms, she claimed it was because he insisted on sleeping with an electric fan running in the room. She didn't like the noise it made, so she had moved to the back bedroom to sleep. Trying a different tack, Mooney then asked her, "Mr. Basemer read the newspapers a great deal, didn't he?"
"Yes, oh yes," she replied.
"Did he read about the Maggio case?"
"The what?"
The Maggio case. Those Italians who were found murdered in bed with an axe and a razor.
Oh, yes. It was like our case, wasn't it?
And you never before saw the axe with which you were apparently struck?
No, we didn't have an axe in the house even.
Mooney left Charity Hospital that afternoon as confused as ever. Was it possible that Bessemer, wishing to kill the woman who passed as his wife, struck her with an axe in order to make it look like the work of the Maggio assailant, whose crime he took such an interest in? Could he actually have inflicted his own head wound as a way of allaying suspicion? Granted, his injury was far less grave than the woman's, but it was serious enough to cast doubt on any such notion. It was now a week since the attacks at the Bessemer grocery, and New Orleanians were clamoring for some, for any, explanation from the city's law enforcement authorities. Mooney had supposedly reformed the notoriously corrupt and incompetent police department, the latest in a long series of attempts to improve the force. But, as in the Maggio case in May, results of any kind in this investigation were distressingly thin. In fact, the two detectives he'd assigned to watch Louis Bessemer had proved to be an all-too-familiar embarrassment to the force. One afternoon, when they were supposed to be surveilling their prime suspect, the two were found at the Milnberg Resort on Lake Pontchartrain, enjoying an afternoon excursion. Mooney had been forced to demote both of them, something that hadn't happened on the force in more than 20 years. Needless to say, this kind of story did not inspire public confidence in the police department or its new superintendent. When speaking to the press, however, Mooney tried to seem confident and in control of the situation. He did admit that the case was one of the most baffling mysteries ever to confront the department, but he assured the public that all avenues of investigation were being vigorously pursued. "We are making progress," he temporized, "and I feel sure that, before we are through, the mystery will have been solved." It's doubtful that New Orleanians found much comfort in these anodynes, but public concern about the crime was apparently on the wane. Many people seemed to have come to the same conclusion as Mooney's detectives, that the attack was the result of some strange domestic quarrel that the Bessemers were determined not to talk about. As such, the case was likely unrelated to the Maggio case, which itself could just have been the result of some obscure Italian feud. Maybe there was no mysterious axe man haunting the streets of New Orleans after all. But then, on July 7th, something happened that immediately changed the complexion of the case. After 11 days of confusion, Mrs. Bessemer apparently got her memory back for real.
"Along toward dawn,"
she told police from her hospital bed, recalling the morning of June 27th,
"I awoke from sleep. I don't know what caused me to wake, but I opened my eyes, and in the light I saw a man standing above me, making some sort of motion with his hands."
She said she told the man to go away, but he remained, still making strange gestures that she couldn't decipher. She said she felt dazed, perhaps because he had already struck her with the axe. But she could describe him. He was tall, heavy-set, a white man, with rumpled, dark brown hair. He wore a heavily soiled white shirt, open at the collar. The next thing she remembered was waking up outside on the gallery, her face in a pool of blood.
"I couldn't breathe," she said. "I was strangling. I tried to get up, but each time I would fall back. There were feet scuffling about me, the feet of a man, clad in shoes that were black and heavy and laced, the kind of shoe a laborer might wear."
But then she blacked out again and remembered nothing else before waking up in the hospital hours later. Hearing this, Superintendent Mooney was inclined to be cautious, aware that this latest recollection of Harriet Lowe Bessemer, if that was her name, might be another fantasy, like her account of being attacked by a mulatto. But for many in New Orleans, the story was credible enough, and it led to a chilling conclusion. The axeman was real, and he apparently was still at large. Chapter 18. Almost as if he had wings. It was 2 a.m. when a woman's scream pierced the silence of the soggy August night. Kate Gonzalez, lying in bed with her husband, bolted awake at the sound. She was confused at first. Had she really heard something, or had she just dreamt it? But then another scream erupted from the darkness, and the sounds of scuffling, a shattering of glass. The commotion seemed to be coming from next door, in the other half of their duplex Elmira Street cottage. This was where Kate's sister lived with her husband and their three young children. Mary Schneider, she knew, was alone with the children that night, since her husband was working a night shift. Kate shook her husband awake. When he also heard the screams, the two of them jumped out of bed and rushed into the street. Several other neighbors were already standing on the banquet, staring at the front door of the Schneider home, which stood wide open like a gaping mouth. Gonzalez and the neighbors entered the cottage, which was quiet now. In the middle room they found Mary Schneider, 9 months pregnant, sprawled across the bed in a state of semi-consciousness. Bloody gashes lacerated her scalp and mouth. Several broken teeth lay scattered on the bedclothes, which were stained with oil from a broken glass lamp that lay on the floor beside the bed. Mary muttered something about being attacked by a tall, heavy-set man, but then fainted before she could say more. Police and an ambulance were called, and Mary Schneider was rushed to Charity Hospital, directly to the maternity ward because of her delicate condition. Toward morning, when Edward Schneider returned from his job at the Southern Pacific Wharf, he found his entire household in an uproar. Police were combing through the cottage and yard for clues, and other officers were searching the surrounding neighborhood. Superintendent Mooney, personally overseeing the investigation with Chief of Detectives George Long, asked Schneider to check the house to see if anything had been taken. A wardrobe in the bedroom had been broken open, and $6 or $7 had apparently been taken from the top shelf. But a box containing $102 of Schneider's back pay had been left untouched in plain sight on the bottom shelf. Nothing else was missing. The newspaper reporters wanted to know immediately whether Mooney regarded this as another Axeman attack. The superintendent was cautious at first. Mrs. Schneider's head wound, he pointed out, was quite possibly caused by the broken oil lamp that had been found beside the bed. In fact, several strands of the victim's hair had been found on the lamp, snagged on the metal prongs that held the lamp's glass chimney to its base. But the wound to Mrs. Schneider's mouth was another matter, obviously caused by something heavier than the lamp. By late Monday, an even more disturbing piece of evidence was found. Mooney's investigators turned up a discarded hatchet in one of the yards neighboring the cottage. Edward Schneider, on examining the premises more carefully, discovered that his own axe was missing from a backyard shed. But did this necessarily point to an axeman? Or could the intruder have seen the axe and carried it away, hoping to make his aborted burglary look like an axeman assault? At the present time, Mooney told reporters on the day after the attack, I am unable to say if it was the axeman who struck Mrs. Schneider, but the finding of the hatchet and the disappearance of the axe is puzzling. Puzzling indeed, though Mooney's reference to the axeman reveals his suspicions that a single perpetrator was responsible for at least some of the crimes. Mary Schneider's was the fourth such assault to occur in the city since Mooney became superintendent less than a year ago. Only one had been fatal, the slaughter of the Maggios back in May. Since the perpetration of that bloody crime, Mooney had learned of an earlier incident back in December 1917 when a sleeping Italian grocer named Epifania Andolina was attacked by a hatchet-wielding man standing over his bed. Andolina had survived, and the story hadn't even made most of the daily papers at the time. But its resemblance to the Maggio incident was eerie. The panel chiseled out of the back door, the lack of any fingerprints or significant robbery, the discarding of the weapon in a neighboring yard. The Bessemer and Schneider cases, though, were somewhat different. The victims in those crimes were not Italian, and only Louis Bessemer was a grocer. As for Mary Schneider, her head wound had proved to be relatively minor, and in fact she would successfully give birth to a baby girl within 24 hours of being attacked. It was possible that Mrs. Schneider, who now claimed to have no memory of the incident, had merely been awakened by a common burglar rifling through the wardrobe, and that the thief had struck her with a convenient object, the oil lamp, when she saw him and screamed. But what then of the allegedly missing axe and the hatchet in the yard next door? All in all, despite the dissonant elements in both the Schneider and Bessemer attacks, Mooney was regarding both, for the time being at least, as part of the Axeman pattern.
His veteran detectives disagreed. Members of the detective squad, detailed by Superintendent Mooney to investigate the attack upon Mrs. Schneider, the Daily States reported on August 7th, have not for a moment entertained the notion that the person who attacked Mrs. Schneider bore the brand of the Axeman. They assert there is no such person as the Axeman going about committing these assaults. They believe that each of the so-called Axe cases was separate and distinct. The officers were not mentioned by name, but they were identified as men who have many years' experience in the handling of criminals of all types. That these veteran detectives would publicly ridicule the whole idea of a serial axe murderer, when their chief and other police officials were on the record as believing that one existed, indicates just how disordered and undisciplined the investigation had become. Certainly the people of New Orleans seemed to believe the Axeman was real. "Armed men guard sleeping families from Axeman," the item announced on the day after the Schneider assault, reporting on all-night vigils kept by shotgun-toting fathers over their sleeping families. The Times-Picayune and the item, at least, seemed totally convinced that some insane beast was at large in the city. The item even went so far as to link the current axe attacks with those that had been committed back in 1910 to 1912. More than 12 victims have fallen under the dreadful blows of the weapon within the past few years, the paper reported, alluding to the Crutti, Dobby, and Chiambra outrages, attributed at the time to the Black Hand. One recalled detail of the 1910 Crutti attack seemed especially haunting. A witness had watched as the perpetrator, who had just chopped grocer Crutti with a meat cleaver, exited the residence by the back door carrying the weapon, his shoes, and the Crutti's pet mockingbird in a cage. After tossing the cleaver away, he scaled a fence, walked to the street, and sat down on someone's front stoop. There he rolled himself a cigarette and smoked it. Then he calmly released the mockingbird from its cage, put on his shoes, and walked away, all while Mrs. Crutti was screaming for help in the house he had just left. If that was the man who was active again now, 8 years later, New Orleans had reason to be in a panic. Superintendent Mooney, meanwhile, was coping as best he could, assigning as many patrolmen as could be spared from his inadequate force to the thinly settled parts of town that the Axeman seemed to prefer. Mooney had been receiving anonymous letters from an alleged forensics expert who claimed to have made a study of criminals, especially perverts, and who was apparently brimming with all sorts of tips and useful advice about apprehending the perpetrator. Modern FBI profilers might speculate that such unsigned missives could very possibly have come from the Axeman himself, but the neophyte superintendent seemed, or pretended to seem, not at all suspicious. He merely appealed to the letter writer through the newspapers, urging him to present himself in person to discuss his ideas. "The man seems to know considerable information about criminals," Mooney told a reporter, "and if he comes to headquarters, I'll be glad to talk to him. He has given much study to the Axeman, it appears from his writings." What Mooney's more skeptical detectives thought of this anonymous expert can be imagined. But then the city was jolted by yet another crime, one that seemed to banish any doubt that an Axeman was at large in the city, and that he seemed strangely drawn to Italian-owned grocery stores. At 3 a.m. on Saturday morning, August 10th, Pauline and Mary Bruno, two teenage girls living in the residence attached to their mother's grocery on Gravier Street, were awakened by the sound of a scuffle in the bedroom next to theirs. "I've been nervous about this Axeman for weeks," Pauline told police. "I couldn't sleep well last night, and haven't slept well for a long time." As she was dozing in bed, the commotion brought her wide awake, and she sat up. "There at the foot of the bed was this big, heavy-set man," she said. "I screamed. My little sister screamed. We were horribly scared. Then he ran." The figure, which she thought was that of a white man, but couldn't be sure, disappeared, almost as if he had wings. Their uncle Joseph Romano, who slept in the room next door, had stumbled into the bedroom a few moments later, holding his head with blood-smeared hands. "I've been hit," he shouted. "Call an ambulance." Then he fell into a chair, fatally wounded, and lost consciousness.
Superintendent Mooney and his detectives were on the scene within an hour, piecing together what had happened. The intruder, armed with the household's own axe from a rear shed, had entered the residence via a broken slat in the kitchen window. He'd apparently gathered Joseph Romano's clothes in the bedroom and carried them into the kitchen, where he rifled through the pockets and found a wallet, which was now missing. Then he had returned to the bedroom and begun hacking at the sleeping form in the bed, fracturing the base of Romano's skull. The assailant may have intended to attack the girls next door as well, but their screams, much louder than their uncle's groans, presumably forced him to retreat, discarding the axe in the rear yard as he fled. Here again, the question of a robbery motive remained unclear. As in so many of the earlier attacks, the perpetrator had obviously ransacked the premises and some small amount of money was taken. But much more was left behind. In Romano's case, a gold watch on the mantelpiece and the victim's own diamond ring. If the axeman was indeed a thief, he was a curiously incompetent one, especially considering his ability to escape from the scenes of his crimes without leaving any tangible clues behind. "I'm convinced that the Romano murder is the work of a madman," Mooney told reporters later that day, "an axe-wielding degenerate who has no robbery motive, but who is taking small sums to throw the police off the track." But the superintendent again tried to reassure the public. "Take this as the gospel. We're going to get him yet. I'm doing everything in human power to run down this murderous maniac." He described his decision to consult with expert criminologists and private detective agencies to aid in the investigation. "This series of axe outrages is the biggest thing in New Orleans police history," he announced. "We are not stopping with the facilities of my own department. I can't tell all of the steps we've taken, but I can tell this much. We've called in outside help." But the public seemed hardly reassured. "Who will be next?" is question Italians asking, read one headline in the Times-Picayune over an article about elaborate precautions being taken among the city's Sicilians. "A literal reign of terror has swept through many quarters in New Orleans," the item reported. In some Italian households, members of the family divide the night into regular watches and stand guard over their sleeping kin, armed with buckshot-loaded shotguns. A kind of hysteria seemed to grip the city as reports of alleged axeman sightings came in from all over town. Numerous people called police to report unfamiliar axes found in their yards, or missing hatchets, or panels chiseled out of their doors. Everyone seemed to have a different theory about the killer's identity, and, significantly, the suspected culprit always seemed to be a member of one of those groups targeted by reformers in the struggles of the past 3 decades. Many thought the axeman was an Italian belonging to the Mafia or the Black Hand. Others thought he must be a crazed black man, like Robert Charles. A few gullible souls, impressed by Pauline Bruno's statement about the axeman's having wings, thought he might be some kind of supernatural being. One wonders, in fact, why no one thought to suspect a disgruntled prostitute or perhaps Tom Anderson himself. Even so, given the preponderance of Italians among the axeman's victims, suspicion fell most commonly on the city's Sicilian underworld. Perhaps for this reason, New Orleans' chief Italian detective, John D'Antonio, sought to deflect criticism from the community he had served for so long. "Although practically all of the victims were Italian," he told the Times-Picayune in an interview published on August 13th, "I do not believe the Black Hand had anything to do with them. I have never known the Black Hand to kill women." D'Antonio instead proposed another theory. "I'm convinced the man is of a dual personality," he said, "and it is very probable he is the man we tried so hard to get 10 years ago, when a series of axe and butcher knife murders were committed within a few months. Students of crime have established that a criminal of the dual personality type may be a respectable, law-abiding citizen when he is his normal self. Then suddenly, the impulse to kill comes upon him, and he must obey it." D'Antonio pointed out that this serial axe murderer, like Jack the Ripper in London some years earlier, would be cunning and hard to catch. He would work methodically, making his plans well in advance to ensure that he wouldn't be caught. But he would have a weakness. "This sort of criminal is easily frightened," the detective claimed. He fears a dog more than he does 10 watchmen. My advice to the public is to put dogs in their yards. Just how many New Orleanians took D'Antonio's advice is impossible to say, but the Axeman hysteria did not dissipate quickly. People were now shooting at suspicious figures lurking in their neighbors' backyards, and every character encountered on the streets at night was seen as a potential Axeman. In one incident, a man named Charles Cardajal insisted he saw the Axeman dressed as a woman, hiding behind a tree on Dupre Street. As Cardajal approached, the figure jumped out from its hiding place and ran away, and Cardajal himself did likewise. The figure later turned out to be a badly frightened Negro woman, who had actually thought that Cardajal was the Axeman. Superintendent Mooney was, if anything, just stoking this paranoia, insisting that any and all suspicious incidents should be reported immediately. "I believe it is criminal for citizens to withhold such cases from police," he announced. "To withhold information means to assist the Axeman in his murderous work." Confronted with scathing criticism for the absence of any arrest in the crimes, Mooney was eager to seem in command of the situation. But he clearly was not, and his repeated confident statements that the perpetrator would be caught were sounding increasingly desperate. On August 19th, however, a development in the Bessemer case allowed Mooney to at least make an arrest. Mrs. Lowe, who had finally admitted that she was not married to Bessemer after all, had recovered sufficiently from her head wound to be released from the hospital, and she had been living again with Bessemer for several weeks in the grocery residence on Dergenois Street. On that Monday morning, she stopped a passing patrolman and asked him to summon the superintendent. When Mooney arrived shortly thereafter, she told him that she had recovered from the trance that had followed the attack on her, and that all of the details of that night had come rushing back to her. "On the night I was assaulted, I asked Mr. Bessemer for money due me. He had promised to pay me $10 a week. It was around 7:30, and the store had just been closed. He was writing on a blueprint. I asked him again for the money, and he turned upon me with the most furious expression I ever saw on a man's face. I became frightened and turned around. Hardly had I taken two steps when I was struck from behind and felled. I heard Mr. Bessemer say, 'I am going to make fire for you in the bottom of the ocean.' I have a recollection then of being dragged over the floor, and next I was in the hallway where there was a light. Oh, how I tried to call out to him that I had done nothing wrong, and how I tried to raise my arm for protection, but I could not speak nor move. Then I felt the stinging pain on the right side of my face. What happened from then to the time I found myself in bed, it seemed like morning then, I don't know." It's doubtful that Mooney put much credence in Mrs. Lowe's sudden recollection. This was the fourth or fifth time she had revised her account of the crime. But the new accusation was enough to have Louis Bessemer arrested on a charge of assault with intent to commit murder. Other revelations by Mrs. Lowe also reignited the Justice Department's interest in the case. Bessemer, she claimed, had gone by several different names in the time they had been together. He told her several times that he was a German Jew, not a Pole, and he had a secret compartment in one of his trunks where he kept blueprints and documents in German. Police and federal agents confirmed this last claim, and that Bessemer had sewn secret pockets into many of his clothes. Bessemer, of course, had explanations for everything. He adopted different names for each of his separate commercial ventures, he said. The secret compartment in the trunk was where he kept his wills, and the hidden pockets in his clothing were for hiding the ample sums of money he handled in his various business endeavors. He also continued to deny that he was anything but a Pole. "Mrs. Lowe is a good woman," he insisted to investigators, "but she was changeable, and she was for some reason telling them lies. She knows who assaulted us. I just want to get to the bottom of this case and solve the mystery." If so, he would have to do it from prison. Worried about Bessemer's ability to pay the bail on a simple assault charge, Mooney had him charged as a dangerous and suspicious character, a crime that in the New Orleans of this day did not require any bail to be set. In the meantime, according to the Daily States, police and federal authorities were giving some weight to the theory that Bessemer may be an enemy agent. and were investigating the matter closely again. Whether or not Louis Bessemer was actually the axe wielder in the attack on Harriet Lowe, few people believed he could be the man responsible for the other axe attacks in the city. And so concern about the dreaded Axeman continued, though alleged sightings of the monster occurred with less frequency as more time elapsed since the Romano murder. By late August, some were even confident enough to see some humor in the situation. "Attention, Mr. Mooney and all citizens of New Orleans," read one notice in the Daily Item. "The Axeman will appear in the city on Saturday, August 24th. It turned out to be an advertisement for a chain of grocery stores. "He will ruthlessly use the Piggly Wiggly axe in cutting off the heads of all high-priced groceries," the ad continued. "His weapon is wonderful, and his system is unique. Don't miss seeing him." By the time autumn arrived, the city had settled down into something like its normal self. The all-night Axeman vigils ended, and impressionable New Orleanians stopped scaring one another on the streets at night. Mooney and his overextended police department, relieved of the intense pressure to produce an Axeman suspect, could turn back to the task of clamping down on the city's vice industry. Not that this was so difficult in 1918. Thanks to heavy-handed War Department strictures and the cresting of the Spanish flu epidemic, which at times required the closing of many public spaces, nightlife in the city remained relatively subdued. Music was still played around town, but aside from the great number of funerals caused by the raging epidemic, gigs were few and far between. Meanwhile, the diaspora of jazzmen to cities north and west continued, and soon claimed some of New Orleans' giants. Sidney Bechet, who had managed to avoid the military draft by claiming that he was supporting his parents, was still suffering from what he called itchy feet, hearing tales of the better life to be had beyond his hometown. "A whole lot of musicianers started to leave New Orleans for up north," he wrote in his autobiography. "They was all writing back to New Orleans that work was plentiful, telling the New Orleans musicianers to come up. It was a real excitement there." Eager to get away, he joined another vaudeville troupe, the Bruce and Bruce Company, and toured throughout the country. When the troupe played in Chicago in May 1918, Bechet decided to stay on. He joined the band led by Lawrence Douay, a fellow clarinetist who had been one of Kid Ory's early bandmates in Laplace. Bechet soon became their featured hot man, and apparently didn't look back. He would never live in New Orleans again. The city lost yet another important player before the year was out. On June 19th, a dance at the Winter Garden played by the Ory Oliver Band was raided by police. Paddy wagons were backed up to the doors at around 11:45 p.m. when the night had barely started, and the frightened patrons were herded into them. "What about the band?" a patrolman asked the sergeant on the scene. "Oh," he said, "I guess I better run them in, too." Any band members who couldn't come up with $2.50 in bail money thus had to spend the night in jail. According to Ory, Joe Oliver was furious at this indignity and totally fed up with the place New Orleans had become. When Ory saw that there was no other way to appease the man, he told him about an opportunity in Chicago, an offer he had recently received to bring his band to the second city. Ory himself didn't want to go, and although he was reluctant to lose the services of one of the best soloists working in New Orleans, he felt he had to offer it to Oliver. The cornetist didn't hesitate to accept the job, and even persuaded clarinetist Jimmy Noon to go with him. This was devastating news for Oliver's young protege, Louis Armstrong. But as with his stint at the Waifs' home, it turned out to be a lucky misfortune. Armstrong later described the day he saw Oliver and Noon off at the station. "I was back on my job driving a coal cart," he wrote, "but I took time off to go to the train with them. Kid Ory was at the station, and so were the rest of the Ory Oliver Jazz Band. It was a rather sad parting. They really didn't want to leave New Orleans, and I felt the old gang was breaking up. But in show business, you always keep thinking something better is coming along." And something better came along for Louis that day. After the train had departed, Ory called him over. "You still blowing that cornet?" he asked. Louis said that he was, so Ory invited him to come play with the band that night in Oliver's stead.
What a thrill that was, Armstrong wrote. To think I was considered up to taking Joe Oliver's place in the best band in town.
Ori wasn't entirely sure the boy was up to it. He remembered the time Louis had subbed for Oliver and could play only a handful of tunes. But Louis had apparently learned a lot from his mentor in the meantime, and Ori saw the boy's potential. So he told him to put on a pair of long trousers and show up for the gig that night at Economy Hall. It became a legendary night in jazz history. Louis showed up looking like a miniature version of Joe Oliver, right down to the bath towel draped around his neck. And by his own account, he managed to blow up a storm. After that first gig with the kid, I was in, he wrote. I began to get real popular with the dance fans, as well as the musicians. But the music scene in New Orleans remained depressed, and Armstrong still had to work various jobs as a saloon bellboy, carpenter, coal cart driver, and, at least until the day he saw a huge rat on the wharves and quit, as a stevedore. He was still delivering coal in his old cart, with Lady the Mule, on the day the war ended, on November 11, 1918, when the armistice was signed.
I was carrying the coal inside Fabaker's restaurant and sweating like mad, he later recalled, when I heard several automobiles going down St. Charles Street with great big tin cans tied to them, dragging on the ground and making all kinds of noise.
When he asked a bystander what was going on, the man told him that the war in Europe was over. The news hit him, he said, like a bolt of lightning. He realized that the end of the war would likely mean a resurgence of jobs for musicians.
I immediately dropped that shovel, he wrote, slowly put on my jacket, looked at Lady and said, so long, my dear. I don't think I'll ever see you again. And I cut out, leaving mule cart, load of coal, and everything connected with it. I haven't seen them since.
But Armstrong's optimism about a revival of New Orleans nightlife proved misplaced. Though the lights did go on in some previously closed clubs, the jazz scene would never return to its old glories. Thanks to the coming of nationwide prohibition, the 18th Amendment was ratified just 2 months after the armistice, the forces of reform would retain the upper hand in New Orleans for years to come. As one music writer has put it, the freewheeling days of the honky-tonks and cabarets were over. And so the atmosphere in New Orleans remained muted. The Mardi Gras celebration in early 1919 proved to be another subdued affair, with little time after Armistice Day to design and assemble any elaborate parade floats. The processions were canceled again, and the few spontaneous street celebrations that did occur were relatively tepid. Even the Axeman seemed to go into hibernation, with Louis Besumer in jail, now on a murder charge, since Harriet Lowe had finally succumbed to her head injury in September 1918, some may have speculated that the Axeman was silent because the actual perpetrator was behind bars. But Mooney and his detectives never seriously entertained the idea that Besumer was responsible for the other Axe attacks. They were convinced that he had killed his housekeeper and then injured himself to make it look like an Axeman attack. The calm, however, proved short-lived. Early on the morning of March 10, 1919, an Italian grocer in Gretna, a town on the other side of the Mississippi, heard screams coming from the grocery across the street from his own store. He ran over and discovered Charles Cortimilia, bloody and unconscious on the floor, and his wife standing over him screaming with a bloody child in her arms. It was clearly an attack like the others. The telltale signs were all there. The missing door panel, the bloody axe left in the yard, no sign of burglary. After a 7-month lull, the Axeman was back. Chapter 19. The Axeman's Jazz. Who is the Axeman, and what is his motive? Is the fiend who committed the Gretna butchery the same man who executed the Maggio and Romano murders, and who made similar attempts on other families? If so, is he madman, robber, vendetta agent, or sadist? New Orleans Daily States, March 11, 1919. It was, in many respects, the most brutal assault so far. A 2-year-old child killed instantly by a single blow to the skull,
her critically injured parents rendered senseless by multiple head traumas. Clotted gore soaked the bed where they all lay. Across the walls and curtains around them, blood spatters radiated like birdshot. And yet, despite this evidence of what must have been a savage frenzy of violence, no one in the neighborhood had heard a thing. The perpetrator had been able to escape without a single witness to the crime, and with hours to spare before his deed was detected. The axeman was apparently becoming even more adept at his trade with time. The crime had been discovered at about 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Several neighbors had made earlier visits to the grocery, which usually opened at 5 a.m., and had merely walked away when they found it closed. But one little girl named Hazel Johnson was more persistent. After getting no response at the front door, she decided to try around back. In the alley leading to the rear of the building, she found a chair set up below a side window. She climbed up on the chair and peered inside, but couldn't see anything in the murky morning light. So she continued down the alley to the backyard. There she found the back door closed, but with one of its lower panels missing. Puzzled, she called a passerby into the yard, and he persuaded her to go inside, perhaps because she was small enough to fit through the missing panel. She crawled in, and moments later burst out the back door screaming. Aroused by this clamor, a young neighbor named Frank Giordano ran over with his aging father, Irlando. They found Charles Cortimilia half-conscious on the floor, and Rose Cortimilia clutching her lifeless toddler and sobbing inarticulately. Her husband, Charles, roused out of his stupor by the younger Giordano, sat up on the floor. "Frank," he said, "I'm dying. Go for my brother-in-law." It was the last thing he would say for several days. Since the town of Gretna was in Lafayette Parish, Peter Lesson, chief of the Gretna police, and Lafayette Sheriff Louis Marrero would conduct the investigation of the Cortimilia case, with Superintendent Mooney's force merely assisting from afar. What Lesson and Marrero found at the scene, however, indicated that the crime was clearly related to the previous year's cases across the river. The axeman's signature modus operandi was obvious, from chiseled door panel to rummaged belongings, with little sign of anything of value actually being taken. This time, a box containing money and jewelry was found undisturbed in the bedroom, along with $129 in cash, hidden under the Cortimilia's mattress. But two trunks and a dresser had been practically torn apart in some kind of frenzied search. Even the face of the mantelpiece clock had been pried open and examined. As in the other axeman cases, however, no fingerprints were found anywhere, and any footprints in the yard had unfortunately been trampled by the curious crowd of neighbors that had gathered at the scene after hearing Hazel Johnson's screams. The discovery of two axes on the premises, one bloody and obviously the murder weapon, another covered with fresh mud, led Lesson to believe that two men might have been responsible for this attack. Perhaps one had stood on the chair in the alley to keep an eye on the victims, and simultaneously on the street, while his partner worked on the back door panel to gain entrance. This two-perpetrator idea could even illuminate one nagging aspect of the earlier attacks. Having an accomplice could explain how the axeman was so successful at eluding detection, even while chiseling away at a back door, an activity that must have been noisy enough to be heard by anyone lying awake in bed or passing on the street. In other words, the axeman may not have had wings, as the impressionable Bruno girl had speculated, but he could have had a second set of eyes, keeping a lookout while he performed his grim duties inside. But Lesson and Marrero were not interested in solving the earlier crimes. They were concerned only with the one in their own jurisdiction, and they pursued their investigation with an aggressive single-mindedness that they would later come to regret. While interviewing the Cortimilia's neighbors, they gleaned hints that the Giordanos might not be the good Samaritans they at first had seemed. According to the neighbors, the two families had been feuding for some time, ever since the Cortimilias had taken over the languishing Giordano grocery in 1916 and turned it into a success. The Giordanos had taken back the business just a few months ago, forcing the Cortimilias to find a shop elsewhere in Gretna. But recently, the Cortimilias had come back, setting up a brand new grocery on the lot adjoining that of the Giordano store. And now, just 2 weeks later,
The Cortamelias were lying near death after being brutally attacked in the night. When asked about the situation, the Giordanos insisted that they had made peace with the Cortamelias and were now good friends, but Marrero had his doubts. Back on the other side of the river, Superintendent Mooney continued to insist that all of the axe attacks, except perhaps for the Harriet Lowe murder, had been committed by a degenerate madman, and that he ransacked the places he enters to create the impression that robbery is his motive. The superintendent's desk was now covered with maps, police reports, and photos of all the axe cases in the city, and he was reportedly poring over them night and day. According to the Times-Picayune, his collection also included the opinions of some of the South's best recognized scientists, placing the axe man in the same class as Catherine de Medici, the French author Sade, and other historic degenerates. But the Gretna authorities had a far more mundane perpetrator in mind for the Cortamelia attack. So sure were they of Frank Giordano's guilt that they kept asking the Cortamelias again and again whether he was the man who assaulted them. The victims were still barely coherent and could do little more than nod or whisper in reply. But while Charles Cortamelia, by some accounts, continued to insist that he did not recognize his assailant, his 21-year-old, highly traumatized wife apparently indicated an affirmative to the question. This was enough for Chief Lesson. He promptly had the younger Giordano arrested, despite the fact that the Cortamelia's doctor refused to vouch for the condition of their minds. Both Charlie Cortamelia and his wife Rosie told me that Frank Giordano had committed the crime, Lesson told a skeptical press. We have worked up a strong case against him, and I am satisfied that the circumstances surrounding the case justified the arrest. Frank Mooney ignored these developments in Gretna, preferring to pursue his own theory of the murders. In a high-profile presentation to the press, including as a visual aid a large city map marked with no fewer than 16 alleged Axeman incidents, the superintendent outlined what he was now calling his panel theory. There were common elements, he claimed, not just in the various axe assaults, but also in the numerous attempted axe break-ins that had been reported throughout the city over the past year. And these common elements convinced him that the crimes were all the work of a single man. The Times-Picayune reprinted the commonalities in full. Location. In nearly all of the cases, a corner house with a high board fence at the side and rear has been selected, and in most instances it was a grocery or bar room or a combination of both. Time. The hour generally has been about 3 a.m. Method. Entrance has been effected by removing a lower panel of a rear door. The plan of work in each instance has been remarkably similar. Weapon. Where the crimes proceeded to the attack, an axe has been used, except in one case where a hatchet was wielded. Sometimes an axe found on the premises, sometimes brought by the murderer, but always an old axe and always left behind. The attack. Always on sleeping victims, with no apparent choice between men and women, and use of the blade of the weapon as a rule. Precautions. Complete failure to find fingerprints, together with the fact a pair of rubber gloves was left behind in one case, leads to the belief that the murderer uses rubber gloves to protect himself against identification by the fingerprint method. Robbery as a camouflage. In practically every axe murder, while bureaus, safes, and cabinets have been ransacked, little was stolen, and money and valuables in plain sight were left behind. And in numerous instances of panel burglaries, the work of the intruder has been so incomplete as to leave strong doubt whether robbery was the real motive. Mooney did acknowledge that each assault and break-in could conceivably be a separate, unrelated incident. He also admitted that they all might be part of a systematic campaign of revenge or terrorism by the Mafia or Black Hand. But he remained convinced that the culprit in all or most of the incidents was a solo maniac, a diabolical, bloodthirsty fiend, cunning and shrewd, as the Times-Picayune described him, a slinking agent of the devil at 3 a.m. Then, on Sunday, March 16th, the city received a kind of confirmation of this macabre description. the Times-Picayune reprinted a remarkable document the paper had received in the mail on Friday. It was an open letter to the public, purporting to be from the Axeman himself, addressed to the newspaper's editor and written in a hand similar to that of the letters received by Superintendent Mooney from the anonymous criminologist. It began with an attention-getting flourish. Esteemed mortal, they have never caught me, and they never will. They have never seen me, for I am invisible, even as the ether which surrounds your earth. I am not a human being, but a spirit and a fell demon from hottest hell. I am what you Orleanians and your foolish police called the Axeman. The letter went on to ridicule the police for their inept investigation of his crimes. The department's antics had been so utterly stupid, in fact, that they had amused not only him, but also His Satanic Majesty and the recently deceased Emperor of Austria, Franz Joseph, among other denizens of hell. Undoubtedly, you Orleanians think of me as a most horrible murderer, which I am, he continued, but I could be much worse if I wanted to. If I wished to, I could pay a visit to your city every night. At will, I could slay thousands of your best citizens, for I am in close relationship with the Angel of Death. The letter writer followed this with a threat, specifying the time of his next appearance. Now, to be exact, at 12:15 o'clock, earthly time, on next Tuesday night, I am going to pass over New Orleans. But those in fear of their lives had one way to protect themselves. I am very fond of jazz, he wrote, and I swear by all the devils in the nether regions that every person shall be spared in whose house a jazz band is in full swing at the time I just mentioned. If everyone has a jazz band going, well, then so much the better for the people. One thing is certain, and that is that some of those persons who do not jazz it on Tuesday night, if there be any, will get the axe. The letter was signed simply, The Axeman. The sensation created by this letter, particularly in the poorer ethnic neighborhoods that had been hardest hit by the axe crimes, can only be imagined. Certainly many, if not most people in the city, must have doubted the authenticity of the document. There was something too slick, too ironic and knowing about the entire exercise to be fully convincing as the ramblings of a crazed maniac. But for a populace traumatized by a bizarre and brutal crime wave, the letter was a shock, hoax or no hoax. After all, something was stalking the streets at night with malicious intent. And if the way to appease the demon was to cut loose for a night, then New Orleans, starved of music and conviviality by the forces of reform, would cut loose with abandon. And indeed, when Tuesday night arrived, the eve of St. Joseph's Day, a major holiday for the city's Italians, New Orleans made sure to mollify its axeman. The tinkle of jazz music coming from dozens of New Orleans homes at 12:15 o'clock Wednesday morning demonstrated that many New Orleanians took the Axeman letter seriously, the Times-Picayune reported on March 19th, and that scores of others who didn't take it seriously found inspiration in it for house parties. Homes and cafes all over town were brightly illuminated and filled with jazz all night long. One group of uptown revelers expressly invited the Axeman to attend their stag party. Enter by way of the bathroom at the head of the stairs, their invitation said. It will not be necessary to remove any panels, for all of the doors will be open. One enterprising local composer even took the opportunity to do some self-promotion. Joseph John Davila claimed to have composed The Mysterious Axeman's Jazz while waiting for the eponymous fiend to make an appearance. By Thursday morning, Davila was already offering the composition, containing every known incidental, accidental, syncopation, flat, sharp, and casualty known to man, for sale to the public. Dedicated to the New Orleans police band, the sheet music was soon being advertised in the daily papers. Immunity promised all homes wherever played, the ad insisted. Davila's marketing ploy was so ingenious, in fact, that one wonders whether he himself may have written the Axeman letter to create an eager market for his new composition. Whether it was the jazz being played all around town, or Superintendent Mooney's decision to put the police on high alert, there was no axe attack in New Orleans on that St. Joseph's Eve. Certainly the night had been a boon for the city's jazz men, suffering from a lack of work under the recent restrictions, and it was apparently just as much a bane for the city's petty thieves. No burglar, as the Times-Picayune pointed out, likes to enter a home where there is a prospect of receiving the welcome of a sawed-off shotgun. But in the days and weeks following the big night, the axeman seemed to go silent. Perhaps he, like the rest of New Orleans, was riveted by the spectacle of two court trials of alleged axe criminals that occurred in the city that spring. In the first, which took place in early May, Louis Bessemer finally got his day in court. Serving as his own best witness, the loquacious grocer testified for 4 hours, telling the jury the same story he had been telling police for months, that he was essentially a prominent businessman running a small grocery as a temporary sideline, that Harriet Lowe was his housekeeper and companion, and that the two of them had probably been attacked by the axeman responsible for so many other assaults in the city. He reiterated that he had no idea why Mrs. Lowe had accused him of the deed, and suggested that she may have been forced to make that dying declaration by an overzealous district attorney. In the end, the jury believed him, or at least they disbelieved the deceased Harriet Lowe. After deliberating for just 7 minutes, they came back with a verdict of not guilty. Later that same month, Frank Giordano and his father Yerlando, who had been arrested 2 days after his son, went on trial for the murder of baby Mary Cortimilia. Here again, the defense attempted to show that the principal evidence against the defendants, the accusation by Rose Cortimilia, had been coerced from a highly traumatized victim influenced by aggressive and tendentious interrogation techniques. Charles Cortimilia continued to insist that the man he struggled with in his bedroom that night was not Frank Giordano. But his wife, appearing in court with shorn hair and head bandages still in place, would not be shaken from her testimony. And although the defense tried to put Superintendent Mooney, Louis Bessemer, and others on the stand to convince the jury that this was another in the long series of axeman cases, the judge ruled their testimony irrelevant. Convinced by a living victim's own testimony, the jury found both Giordanos guilty. The case would eventually be appealed to the state Supreme Court, but in the meantime, Frank was sentenced to death, and his father, perhaps because of his age, was given life in prison. Evincing some agitation after the verdict, Rose Cortimilia stood up and tried to make an announcement to the court. "You can say what you want, but before God," she began, but the judge did not allow her to finish. So at least one axeman candidate was convicted, but few New Orleanians thought that it was the true culprit who was headed to the gallows. No one, in fact, had ever even suggested that Frank Giordano might be responsible for the other axeman assaults. Meanwhile, Superintendent Mooney and his police were coming under increasing criticism for their uselessness. "There is no getting away from the fact that the police department of the city is utterly incompetent," claimed an open letter from the Citizens League, printed in the Daily Item. 7 unsolved axe murders, a resurgence of prostitution in the city, and a host of police scandals, according to the League, indicated a growing crisis of leadership in New Orleans. Had the hard-won victories of the forces of reform during the war years been in vain? Was New Orleans once again to descend into the chaos, lawlessness, and turpitude of the not-too-distant past? As if in answer to these questions, the axeman soon made his presence felt again. At 3:15 a.m. on Sunday, August 4th, in a house at 2123 2nd Street, virtually around the block from the uptown residence in which Buddy Bolden had lived for much of his life, a scream again rent the silence of a summer night. Sarah Lauman, a 19-year-old woman asleep in her parents' house, woke in pain to find someone looming over her in the bedroom. "I felt a stinging of my left ear," she later explained, "and I saw a man standing over me under the mosquito bar." That's when she screamed, and the man bolted away, scrambling out an open window. By the time her parents had rushed into her room from their own bedroom next door, the intruder was gone. But had he been the axeman? There was no blood in the bed, and Sarah Lauman didn't even realize she was injured until several hours later, when she found a small but painful laceration behind her left ear. Was this the result of a glancing blow from an axe that had perhaps gotten tangled in the mosquito netting? One wonders how many axe victims' lives were saved by this ubiquitous New Orleans necessity. But Lauman had seen no axe held by the man standing above her bed. Hours later, an axe was found under the school building next door, which was under repair, but it had no bloodstains on it. And the Laumans, unlike so many other victims, were not grocers, Italian or otherwise. And yet Sarah's description of her white assailant matched that of the Bruno girl in the Romano case a year earlier. "He was about 5 feet and 8 inches tall," she told police, "had a dark complexion, weighed about 160 pounds, and wore a cap pulled down over his eyes, dark coat and pants, and a white shirt with dark stripes." Axeman attack or not, the Lauman incident set off yet another round of hysteria throughout the city. Less than a week later, a grocer named Steve Boca stumbled to the door of a neighbor on Elysian Fields Avenue with a bloody gash in his head and no idea what had happened to him. Police discovered that his house had been broken into via a chiseled-out panel in the back door. A bloody axe had been left on the kitchen floor. Then, on September 2nd, a druggist named William Carlson, lying awake reading, heard sounds coming from his back door. Panicking, he called out a warning, but when the noise continued, he fired a shot at the closed door with his revolver. When he worked up the courage to open the door, he found that one of its lower panels had been scored with chisel marks. By now, the people of New Orleans seemed prepared to believe that the Axeman was everywhere, and that Mooney and his police could do nothing to stop him. This became terrifyingly apparent when, on the night of October 27th, Deputy Sheriff Ben Corcoran, returning late to his home on Scott Street in Mid-City, heard yet another scream coming from yet another Italian corner grocery. He ran to the end of the square and found 11-year-old Rose Pipitone out on the street, bellowing that her father was full of blood. When he entered the premises, he found Mrs. Michael Pipitone, whom he knew as a neighbor, distraught and near hysteria. "Mr. Corcoran," she wailed, "it looks like the Axeman was here and murdered Mike." The crime scene was by now sickeningly familiar. Mike Pipitone lay in a gore-soaked bed with a fractured skull and the entire left side of his face beaten in. This attack had apparently been particularly savage. Bloodstains spattered the bedroom walls to a height of 8 feet. The obvious murder weapon lay on a chair beside the bed, but it was not an axe or a hatchet. It was a foot-long thick iron bar with a large iron nut screwed to its end. Mike Pipitone, rushed to Charity Hospital, died there at 3:15 a.m. of massive hemorrhaging in the brain. Later, after Superintendent Mooney and Detective Long had arrived on the scene, Mrs. Pipitone explained what had happened. She had been sound asleep until she heard her husband's cries in the darkness beside her. "Someone was calling me," she told them. "The cry seemed to get louder and nearer, and suddenly I opened my eyes and I heard my husband say, 'Oh my God,' that is all he said. And then I saw the forms of two men. I could just see the outlines of their figures as they hurried from our room into the children's room and disappeared in the darkness. I turned to my husband," she continued. "What I saw terrified me. Every time he turned his head, blood came from his head and face. It simply poured over the bed." That's when she jumped up, ran into the dining room window, and began to scream for help. This was another horrifying crime, but again, as in the Lauman case, it seemed questionable whether this was indeed an Axeman assault, for several reasons. Most obvious of them, the murder weapon was not an axe. The means of entry, through a smashed side window, was another atypical element in the Axeman repertoire. And Mrs. Pipitone seemed certain that she had seen two men, not one, fleeing in the darkness. In fact, if not for her initial remark to the deputy sheriff, not to mention the ongoing serial killer obsession in the city, one wonders whether the deed would have been considered an Axeman crime at all. Mooney's detectives eventually turned up a different, intriguing possibility. linking the Pipitone murder to the rash of mafia killings that had broken out in the years following the LaManna kidnapping in 1907. The 1910 shooting of Paolo Di Cristina, after all, had been laid at the door of Mike Pipitone's father, Pietro. At the time, some detectives had even believed that Mike actually did the shooting. Now free on parole for that crime, the senior Pipitone had been in the house when his son was killed. But although the police questioned him and numerous others involved in the Di Cristina murder, including all of the attendees at Mike Pipitone's funeral, they could find no connection to the current crime. When asked by a Times-Picayune reporter whether Mooney had any theory to explain the apparent coincidence, the superintendent frankly admitted that the police have not the slightest clue. It was, in any case, to be the last alleged Axeman crime. Several suspects were arrested for one or another of the axe crimes over the next weeks, but all eventually had to be released for lack of evidence. And as time passed without another axe attack, the hysteria in the city subsided. Even the Giordanos, convicted in the Cortimilia case, were ultimately released. Young Rose Cortimilia apparently had a nighttime visitation from St. Joseph, who urged her to clear her conscience before she died. She subsequently recanted her testimony against the Giordanos. "Everyone kept saying to me that it was them," she explained, and so she began to believe it. "I was not in my right mind." But now she claimed to understand the seriousness of her false accusation, and she apologized to her erstwhile neighbors. "God, I hope I can sleep now," she told the judge, who, after some procedural difficulties, managed to get the convicted murderers released. And so even this one solved axe crime became unsolved once more. But although there would be no more murders in the night, the shadowy axeman would claim one more victim. Superintendent of Police Frank Mooney, under continuing criticism for his inability to solve the murders, was eventually forced to resign in late 1920. He went back to the job he did best, running a railroad, which he did in the wilds of Honduras until his death after a heart attack in August 1923. But the Axeman ordeal did have a final chapter. Late in 1921, New Orleans police would learn something that would shed new light on the long series of attacks, pointing to one well-known career criminal who might have been responsible for the mayhem. See afterward. In the meantime, the case remained unsolved, and the city seemed to forget about its nemesis. Order had been restored to the streets, and the city had returned to its more circumspect post-war self. The ever-conservative Times-Picayune seemed positively delighted by the quieter, more respectable atmosphere. After New Year's Day of 1920, the paper could report on an admirably sober observation of the holiday. "Punctiliousness, primness, and prudery prevail here," read the headline in the January 2nd issue, over an article about the tameness of the usually raucous celebration. "The first day of the new year was observed rather than celebrated," the paper reported. "With hushful sabbatical ceremony, New Orleanians paraded with dignity and aplomb, feeling that they looked as virtuous as they felt. Casualties were few, and arrests were practically nil." But the reformers, though clearly in the ascendant, were not finished with the city quite yet. There was, after all, still one symbolic figure who had survived this triumph of supposed virtue in New Orleans. Tom Anderson, the erstwhile mayor of Storyville, was still sitting in his seat of power in the state legislature. In order for the reform revolution to be complete, many felt that this situation had to be rectified. Tom Anderson, and the political machine that supported him, would have to be destroyed entirely.